Welcome to episode 166 of the Adventure Audio Podcast. Thank you everybody for your patience. It's been over a month since we've been able to get an episode out to you. Life has been happening and adventures have been happening. So we're hoping to have shorter breaks than that typically, but this is well worth the wait, this one. We are hosting Simon Willis on this podcast. He is the host of the very popular YouTube channel and also a podcast called Always Another Adventure. So the best place to find Simon and links to all of his content, which is really, really well done and very high value content, definitely worth your time in a very consumable and entertaining format. And you can visit alwaysanotheradventure.com. That will plug you directly into Simon, who is just awesome. So Simon, thank you again very much for making the time to spend with Laval and I. We greatly appreciate it. And like most of our guests, we would love to have you back on. So thank you again for doing that. Everybody, thank you for listening. As always, the greatest way for us to grow our audience and to reach new podcast listeners and to have some impact in their life is simply by word of mouth. So if you're able to give us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show, but then if you have somebody in your life that you think would appreciate what we're doing at Adventure Audio, please let them know about it. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. We will get right on to this episode with Simon Willis from Always Another Adventure.
The first thing I want to note for our listeners is that you're wearing a very Canadian thing on your head. I think in the UK you call that a beanie, but in Canada we call that a toque.
Yeah, actually, I heard you talk about that in one of your podcasts, actually, a toque. But that's different to the Inuit toque, isn't it? Which is the oval limb piece thing.
Yes. Well, yes. So the word, the original word toque is obviously a French word, and it's the original term for a chef's hat. So I don't know how we as Canadians have adopted that, but for us that is only a toque. It's that ubiquitous knit cap or a beanie, depending on what part of the English speaking world you're from, but it's a French word and we've proudly used it in Canada as their only description for that hat.
Well, I think I just called it a hat. Canada is a result of most people moving to Eastern Canada originally, and a lot of English and French speaking people, and then there's obviously a contingent of Gaelic speaking and all of that stuff that kind of just meshed in Eastern Canada and moved across the country. And that's how we get words like toque commonly used.
Well, there you
indeed.
Go.
Indeed. Well, Simon, this is exciting. I've been watching your YouTube series for quite a while now, and I was always impressed with the quality of it. I was impressed with your voice as a podcaster and as a broadcaster. And then I started doing some digging and realized that you were previously working for the BBC, and it all made perfect sense to me, the level of professionalism that you put into your videos. So thanks for the great content. Thanks for agreeing to be on our little podcast.
I have a secret weapon because I have Scotland on my side. I have the scenery that we have outside there. So if I'm just doing something boring, I just go for a ride and talk about it on the ride. And, you know, the scenery takes over. It really makes a big difference having that in your back pocket. Okay, great. Well, I'm pleased you enjoy it. It actually amazes me that anybody ever gets to see it. But it's true, particularly, I think this early athlete series has taken off in a way that surprised me initially. And there's just a sort of a generation of folks now over the age of 60 who don't want the pipe and slippers. I think it's possibly coming out of the time when we all had manual heavy jobs, and really by the time you got to 60 you were either broken or you just wanted to relax and take it easy. And nowadays those manual heavy jobs are fewer and further between. And consequently, we've used our activities as our leisure pursuits, and we want to keep them going. That's what we do. That's the other side of our lives, and we just want to keep that going. And just finding out how we can do it. And actually, a lot of the medical science hasn't actually caught up with our aspirations yet. And exploring that sort of edge, I have found really interesting.
Yeah, you and look. You... Simon, you and Laval are definitely kindred spirits in that respect, for sure. But I just watched the. I've been recently introduced to the YouTube series, so I'm going to go on a massive deep dive now. Obviously, I'm totally enchanted by the scenery and your production style. So, but I just watched the video about VO2 Max, which is exactly that's I think the last one you've done in the most recent one you've done in your Aging Athlete series.
Yeah, I had some good help with that.
Doesn't even know what that is, right?
I had some really good help with that because this is going to sound like a plug for the channel, but there are people who kind of pay to be members with your channel, and the way I've tried to use that is to get folks more involved in the production, because when you are just, I'm used to being in an environment with a newsroom, and one of the best things about that is kicking around ideas, kicking around, developing things, and people coming back going, you sure that's right? Could we not do this? Could we not do that? And then having people who you can put out rough cuts to and say, guys, what do you think of this? And one of them turns out to be an absolute expert in this. He literally wrote the textbook. He sent me a copy of a textbook. So that's why they took 8 iterations to get that VO2 Max 1 happy quality for him, and also quality enough for me to be spot on. And I've learned a lot in the process as well, because I'm not an expert in this. Absolutely not. I'm not a coach. I'm not a doctor. I'm a journalist, but I'm quite used to going to find out the sources, find out the right people. I was a health correspondent for the BBC for a while. And hopefully I've got the right approach. Journalist can be a bit of a dirty word nowadays. So, you know. You've got to take that with a pinch of salt.
What brought this interest in the outdoors and fitness and take our listeners through your story from the kayaking books to the open water swimming?
That'll only take about 65 years, which is what I am. I first went into TV in a carry cot. I was a baby, because my dad was a producer-director right in the early days of TV. And I always thought, well, it's going to be interesting. You're always going to be interested in what your dad does. I mean, if you'd been a plumber, I'd have been interested in plumbing. I'm sure of it. So I didn't want to do anything like that at university in the media studies courses when I went to university. So I did economics, which I enjoyed. But in the final couple of years, there was a student TV unit. And I got involved making some dreadful programs for them. But I just got the bug. So at the end of it, I thought, I'm going to give myself a year and see how it goes. Because it was interesting. And that's how I sort of fell into TV, through doing little bits of radio, going in, answering phones for a phone-in quiz. And literally one thing led to another. I got a job as a presenter doing continuity, popping up in between programs as we used to have, and then found myself applying for a TV reporter's job at the BBC. And nobody thought I would get it because I wasn't a journalist, but I had actually made some non-broadcast films. And so I could take in and say, yeah, these people have written articles. I've made these videos, big VHS cassettes. And they took a chance on me. I don't think it would happen today. But actually, it was making those non-broadcast things, and one of them was how we learned to ski. There was a thing to do. I was not really interested in skiing, but I thought, well, you know, get a chance to make a film. And in the northeast of England, where I ended up being employed shortly after that, we have the English Lake District, and it's a big climbing area, big hill walking area. And I hadn't realized how close it was. And having recently been in the Alps doing this skiing film, and then I remember coming back from a jog, driving through, I could literally take you to the lay-by that I pulled over and went, wow, look at these mountains. These are really cool. And from there, I was kind of hooked a bit on the outdoors. And I always tried to pilot my career, pun intended, to sort of steer a course between the TV and enjoying the outdoors, because if you really, really, really want to be the top in making TV programs or presenting or reporting, you have got to want it more than life. You've got to be so committed to that. And I wasn't. I wanted to spend time in the outdoors. I wanted initially backpacking, then climbing, and then lots of other bits and pieces. I've done loads of things, none of them that well, but I've collected quite a range of experience from that. And so I didn't do the big London thing. I was never a network correspondent because I was never happy to be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which you have to be. So I've always managed to keep those two things side by side. And it was great in a way. The two biggest things have been when I joined the BBC, brilliant for my career, and when I left them again, when I took an early retirement and I could go and do my own thing, totally separate from that. So I learned a lot doing it. I had a great time doing it, went to some interesting places, met lots of interesting people, including Margaret Thatcher, I believe. Yes, I think. Yes, she shouted at me once. Then I've had almost as much time not being in the BBC as being in the BBC in many ways now.
So what brought you to things like the Pacific Crest Trail, walking it from Mexico to the Canadian border? How did a kid that grew up to be a broadcaster in the UK end up stomping into the mountains of the southern US, heading all the way up to the border of Canada?
I'm a great believer in things finding you, that you don't necessarily pick what your adventure is going to be. If you're receptive, they will come knocking on your door. So when my father died in the 80s, I'd been reading a book about this strange little route in northern Spain. It's very well known. I am going to answer your question, but it's the wrong way around. Very well known now, the pilgrimage to Santiago, but it wasn't in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that well known. And then I started finding Postela, Santiago, written everywhere, including in a banner headline on the English language newspaper. My parents retired to Spain, I should have said that. And written in the English language newspaper on the day of his funeral, literally it said Santiago written across it in whatever it is, point type.
Wow.
And it was like, well, do you know what? I'm going to have to do this because I wanted to see what it was that made my dad uproot from the north of England and go and live there. So that found me. And the Pacific Crest Trail was very much one of those things like that. It started with the John Muir Trail. And again, I had found an old copy of National Geographic, April 1977. And Gwendolyn Rowell, who, legendary photographer, I've got some of his books just in the cupboard over there. He had done a photographic assignment about the John Muir Trail, which was very little traveled at that time, again. And I think, I don't know where I was, I had been doing a bit of parallel writing for a hiking magazine here in the UK. And I possibly was staying in a hostel or somewhere, and they had one of these old magazines, and I saw it, and I actually asked them and said, can I keep this? And I kept it with me because I thought, I'm going to do this, because it was much later. And so I went and thought, this sounds a really good thing to do. And the John Muir Trail was a bit better known by then. We're talking about the mid to late 90s. And when I was on that, and I was out for 2.5 weeks or whatever it was, and fascinating stories just getting there, but I'm cutting to the chase here. I was on a boat going across Edison Lake to Vermilion Valley Resort, which was then run by a guy called Butch Wiggins, who since committed suicide, but he was an amazing figure. And I was writing this up for the Sunday Times newspaper as well. I went back to see his widow, actually, after the profile I did. But I was sitting on this boat thinking, there and I'm this roughy-tufty hiker out for 3 weeks. And there's a guy with a rucksack than me on the other side of the boat. And I said, so where are you going? And he said, oh, I'm doing the Pacific Crest Trail. What's that? And he explained it to me as we're going over this lake. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And that was it. It had found me. You know, I almost didn't have a choice after that. I knew I was going to do it. It was purely going to be a question of when. And I just had to engineer my life into the situation where that happened. And along the way, I ended up getting divorced. partly because it was considered unreasonable behavior to want to go and quit your job and walk the length of America for 6 months. And I can see that for other people, it would be considered unreasonable behavior. And that was actually cited as part of it. But I was quite determined to do it. And in the end, the BBC said, look, you know what? You can come. We'll give you a sabbatical for 6 months off your pop. And I went and did it. I then met someone and we did it together. And she's now downstairs just cooking some pizza, actually, at the moment. She just gave me a bit before we started. We've been married for 20 years now, or been together for 20 years. And that's how the PCT found me. Well, it's changed a lot, I gather, in that. Say, I'm doing a monologue here, and I'm sorry, I ask a question. It's the only problem with me. You can drop a penny in the slot, and I go.
I love it. It sounds like that was a pilgrimage in your life. I mean, it sounds like there were so many changes that occurred because of that.
Well, it's interesting, actually. I was reading someone else was writing about this beforehand, that it's like the footsteps in the snow. When you're making them, you never know. You can't really see your direction. You can't really see your direction changing very often. So when you turn around and look back, you can see how it's all linked together and how it's all formed this sort of cohesive line to take you to where you are now, emotionally, physically, mentally, the whole thing. And it does feel like that, because it actually led me to... We got to Washington State, and then we got to the end in Vancouver, and we thought, you know what? We're not going to go look back again for quite a while. We have got the T-shirt. We've got the badge. We're not doing that. And some people we met invited us to stay for a day or two in Seattle, and we went out sea kayaking with them. And this was, oh, like this. And so that opened up a whole new era of our lives. And it led us to where we live now. It led us to make three sea kayak coaching films with a chap called Gordon Brown, who's recently moved back from Vancouver. And it led us to have an idea of the Scottish Sea Kayak Trail, which was based very much on the idea of the books of the Pacific Crest Trail, in that guidebooks until then had said, here are your good campsites, this is where you stop and all that. And I took the approach was, no, you never do that, because you're going to create honeypot areas. You always assume that people, you never know how far people can go in a day. You don't know what the weather conditions are like. You don't know what their conditions are like. And so it changed so much. And I can only see that turning around and looking back.
What a beautiful way to describe it. I love that. You probably had no idea that PCT was going to have this massive impact on your life. I mean, I didn't know that that's how your sea kayaking loves kicked off, was after the PCT doing that kayaking off of Seattle. Because for our listeners, you have the I think it's the top selling ever video series on sea kayak training. You and Gordon Brown did that together.
Yeah, I think it was my production skills, mainly Gordon Brown's coaching, because he's one heck of a good coach. They've done phenomenally. In fact, I remember someone who made climbing films, very successful climbing films, said to me, because this was back in the day of DVD when we were doing them. He said, you know, a really good selling DVD for this sort of niche, when you're putting them out yourself, you can sell about, I think, sell about 3,000 copies. That's really, really good. Well, over 15,000, 20,000, I think it is at the moment. So, and they're still going, even things we shot in 2006. And that's before HD. There wasn't a GoPro when we shot our first one. But the techniques are still the same. And they were such fun to do. We initially took them to a production company that I worked quite a lot with at the time. We were making programs for the BBC, so outdoor adventure programs. And they costed it out and said, there's no way you can make money on this. And we said, oh, we're going to give it anyway. And I remember saying to Gordon the night before I pressed the button on actually going ahead and organizing the DVDs, I said to him, if this makes a loss, we are going to share the loss, yeah? And he says, yes, of course. And we only, because we were hesitant, we ordered 700 copies rather than 1,000, because we were like, oh, you know, we mightn't sell 1,000. We better just do 700. And every now and again, he reminds me of that. And yeah, it was a great time. It was a good time. The book's now out of print, the Scottish Sea Kayak Trail. And it's such, it was so difficult to redo it, I think, that I've just sort of let it lapse and thought, well, you know, that was a period in time. I've moved on to other things and quite happy so to do. So there's always something else. And that was the title of the channel, Always Another Adventure, because I'm always looking for the next one. And I bet you guys are as well, Peter, Laval. I'm sure you are looking forward to your next adventures.
100%. Well, Laval's usually looking forward to the next and then the next. And that I think he usually has 7 or 8 sort of in various states of completion.
Pretty remarkable,
but yes, always.
What I was wondering, Laval, is why always the highest mountain when it's not necessarily the best mountain?
Oh, that's a good question. You're going to turn the microphone around.
Now the BBC presenter, journalist, has come out.
We were discussing it. My wife and I were discussing it, and she was saying, yeah, but, you know, Ben Nevis here in Scotland, that's not our best mountain. What about slightly lower ones that are really good?
I guess the problem with that, I guess, is it's so subjective, Simon. What is the best according to who, according to what standards, according to what experience? And just because it's the highest does not make it the best for sure. I mean, when people ask me about all the peaks I've climbed, and the favorite ones are not the, are not these, you know, Himalayan giants or the, you know, it's smaller peaks, and it sometimes has to do with more what happened on the flanks of the mountain than getting to the summit, the cultural experiences, the people you meet, or the wildlife you see. So I think the best at anything is so subjective, it would be hard to pick out what would be the best mountain. So, but I do think, though, is that always back to your initial Always Another Adventure, is that when you do travel, whether it's be it in your own country or internationally, this, if you're looking for adventure, or in your case, sometimes if adventure just befalls you and then befalls more adventure, et cetera, it just makes the experience so much better, because generally in the type of things that the three of us do and that our listeners do, we're going into the remote areas of a place. And to me, that's where the real richness is in an area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, nature does its best work in out-of-the-way places, doesn't it?
That's well put.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's possibly why we choose to live.
Sorry. I'd like to know.
Sorry, you go ahead. My apologies.
Yeah, no, not at all. This is going to happen all the time because just for our listeners, just so they realize what's going on here, Pete is sitting in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. We've got Simon in Scotland, and I'm sitting in the mountains in Vietnam, in northern Vietnam, near the Chinese border. So
it's kind of amazing.
It is amazing. And I mean, fairly appropriate for the podcast and for your YouTube channel too, I think, that we found ourselves in these circumstances. But it is, I mean, what a treat. Like, you couldn't, as much as people would have loved to have done something like this, even 20 years ago, it simply didn't exist, right? And it's funny, I was just talking to my mom about the podcast. I'll go on my own little tangent here.
Good.
And she was asking about, like, you know, why did you start it and what's it all about and kind of what's the idea behind it? Not an adventurer at all, my mom. And I said, you know, like, it's about basically, first of all, it's miraculous that it to me that this can even happen. I also love the fact that this is recorded and left as a legacy. I don't know, it gives me some sort of weird comfort to know that there's going to be hundreds of hours of me recorded that my great grandkids could listen to if they wanted to, which I think is really neat. And if I could watch, if my grandfather had an Instagram account that I could go look at and see when he was in England stationed in the war and stuff, I would be watching that all the time.
Yeah, so, good point.
You know, it's really cool that we can do this kind of stuff. But I told her that the purpose of this podcast for me selfishly is that I already feel like I'm more adventurous and mentally tough than 98 out of 100 people. The podcast is me trying to find the other 2 out of the 100 and interview them and find out what makes them tick, because those are the most interesting people to me. And that's kind of what it's about.
Yeah, I think I get that. I think I've been fortunate as well, because I, as well as the sort of like the bog standard part of my job with the Beeb, was I got to climb or do stuff with some pretty interesting adventurers. So I've climbed with Sir Christian Bonington. Sure. I've done stuff with Alan Hinks. Alan Hinks actually is still a pal, who was first Brit to do the 8,000 meter peaks. So I guess that was reasonably originally why I started the Always Another Adventure podcast, because that it was literally the Monday morning of lockdown when I woke up and thought, we're all going to be bored, and what are we going to do? And I thought, well, there'll be all these people who can't go out and do their adventures. They're not going to be stuck at home. There's all these people who actually can't go and do their sort of slightly less, great for them, or great for me as well. We can't do ours. Why don't we use this opportunity to talk to the people who you don't normally, you couldn't get because they're scattered around the planet having adventures? And so that's kind of what I did. I met a few of them in Scotland. It's changed a bit now. I'd met a few of them in Scotland. So we were just rattling off people, and I managed to get some really, really great conversations. But to go back with podcasts, I started a podcast. My first podcast was in 2006, and it's Sea Kayak Podcasts. And it was because I was really into it. It's now on a legacy hosting site. Oh, no, it's on Spotify. That was it. It's hosted on Spotify. And I haven't updated that since, my goodness, it must be 2010, if that. And yet it still gets like 30,000 downloads a year. It's exactly what you mean.
Really?
It's what you're talking about. There's that history. It's just totally sat there. People who just come into Sea Kayaking discover it. And the first people to go around South Georgia are still the first people to have gone around South Georgia. So you know, the archive, as it were, is still there and still living. And it's quite nice if you stumble across stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to butcher it, but there's a Carl Sagan quote about the beauty of a book, because it's essentially, he's describing like how it allows you into somebody's mind. And now we have, for centuries, that was really the only thing that we had, right? Mm-hmm. Now we've got YouTube, now we have video, now we have podcasts. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool way to reach people and to connect. I mean, I've had an opportunity to talk to people who, that I just would, it never would have happened, never would have existed. I wouldn't have even known about them if it wasn't for these types of things.
Well, I haven't spoken to anybody who's ever done the Seven Summits before, so there you go. And I'm speaking to someone, Laval, who has. I've read Dick Bass's
book. It sort of shrinks the world.
Oh, wow. A long time ago.
But he's not the original, though. You know, the original is a Canadian, though. Patrick Morrow.
Oh, well, there you go. I didn't know that.
So, yeah, the Morrow. Yeah, so Dick Bass did the Seven Summits, but he climbed Kosciuszko instead of Karstens Pyramid in Indonesia. And Kosciuszko, as you know, is just a walk up. And so Patrick Morrow, who is a Canadian climber that I know, he was my hero growing up. He did the Morrow variation, so he did all of them. But to make sure he got the highest in Australasia, he did Karstens Pyramids.
Well, there you go. I didn't know that. You think it's great, excellent.
So we're talking. I heard the word Carl Sagan and the word books and inspiration, and now we've got YouTube, and now I've got podcasts. But you and I and Pete grew up in a time where we didn't have any of this. We had what would we call? We'd call it terrestrial television. We had radio, and we had books. So. What were the books? Because I was influenced in my adventurous life by reading. So what were the books that you read, Simon, growing up that turned you into who you are?
I think there's adventuring business. So I don't really think of myself as an adventurer, okay? I have just someone who's had this sort of parallel career. It's much more about communicating, and I'm not dodging your question, but it's much more about communicating the normal adventures, not I could never dream of doing the Seven Summits. In fact, I don't know if I'd want to, because I think my ambitions are more modest, more scattered as well. So the books, I read lots for my work through school. I think that was more the thing. I think the stuff I read for fun was actually science fiction stuff. I loved science fiction when I was growing up, and my dad used to write it. When going back in the day, even before regular entertainment on TV, he was an English teacher, and to pay a little bit extra, he had a sideline. So I mean, there's always been this thing in our family of sidelines. So he used to write for the little, I think they called them pulps. They had the little sort of small magazine size things. They're not even A4, not regular magazines. They're kind of half A4, A3. No, is it A3 or is it, what's the half A4 where you cut it down the middle and turn it sideways? Anyway, whatever. That size little pulp thing. And they were the, and he used to, I remember he used to write under the science fiction name of Earl Van Loden. And that's why I probably got into the science fiction. But also through school, the stuff I studied English literature, so I read most of the books. That took a lot of time. In fact, we've only just recently gone back to poetry. So we're looking, we're just taking out some poetry books, saying we're missing a lot of poetry in our lives. So we've been looking through Poems on the Underground and stuff like that. But I used to like looking at the way people used words. I was never very humorous, but I loved the way comics and well-written comedy structured itself, like Spike Milligan, people like that. I could tell you any one of Spike Milligan's poems just about. I know them off by heart. So it was literally more about that communicating side of things rather than the adventuring. They sort of like the ideas of Boy's Own Adventure never really did it for me. I wasn't that adventurous as a kid. I'm saying that we had some woods down the back of our house, and we were forever up and down trees. I think we just did it. We didn't think about it. We didn't read about it. We just went out and did it, you know.
And that's the thing that's disappeared now, is that you don't see kids out and about in the bush doing stuff anymore. They're always on their phones. I mean, Jan and my wife and I just commented. I just said, pause for a second on the street here in Hanoi and look around, or Saigon, wherever we were that day. And literally every human being was on a phone.
Yeah.
It was people on scooters, people parked at lights, little kids, old ladies. Everybody was on a phone. And I mean, God only knows where this is going to go. But
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
You go by playgrounds now, and there's kids are not in playgrounds.
It has changed significantly, and I have young people in my house, and it's a lot different. And I did grow up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, but I grew up in a house where there was literally not a fence. My backyard led right into a ravine, which at, you know, when I was a little kid felt enormous. Like I still don't live far from there. If I jog up there and run through it, now I realize it's only probably takes me 10 minutes to go the entire length of it. When I was a little kid, I'd spend the entire summer in that ravine with my friends. And you know, that's definitely changed quite.
And if you were doing stuff there, Peter, that nowadays would probably be considered too dangerous.
Definitely, we were trying to build little forts in trees. We were digging traps. All kinds of
starting fires.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you name it. It just expect what we were free range kids by comparison. Now I know we sound like three grumpy old white guys. But you know, it's changed significantly. So even though there's this magic of social media and stuff, which is incredible, and just as we're talking about how the three of us are able to connect today, it does rob us of a lot of stuff too. So it's a difficult thing to try and find that balance for people.
Let me ask you guys a question: do you think we kid ourselves that these conversations, the Instagrams, the videos? Do you think we kid ourselves that these inspire people?
No. And I think that's a good question, but I know that we aren't, because I receive messages, and we don't have a large podcast audience, Simon. I think comparatively to what you have as a YouTube audience, we don't, but I get messages from people literally all over the world, English-speaking countries, typically. It's an English podcast. But I've received messages from New Zealand, Japan, Scotland, England, Australia, all over the United States and Canada, of people who have listened to our podcast and have been inspired to do things. There was a lady who reached out from Eastern Canada earlier this year who had was in between jobs, had left one career and was preparing to go into another one. And because of listening to Laval and I, went and bike packed this past summer across Europe, which is mind blowing. This is somebody that I didn't even know. So that's what keeps me going and what keeps me finding a way to fit this into the rest of my life. It is, as you're saying, it's funny. There's some people who always need a little bit of something extra beyond what they have in their own world or career. That's what this is for me. But it's incredibly inspiring to me, and it keeps me going to hear from total strangers to found that we've impacted them in some way. That's an incredibly meaningful thing to me.
I was looking at your Aging Athlete series and the comments, and you know this because you have, I mean, some of those videos you're getting over 500,000 views, but the comments are just about unanimously, thank you for this, Simon. I'm a 75-year-old. I was told that I could never, my doctor said I couldn't do this. I thought I was not able. And all those statements were prefacing the fact that because of your videos, these people are now stepping out. Now, they don't have to do a huge ride in the Lake District or run up Ben Nevis or do a cold water swim in some loch in Scotland, but it's all relative, just like you're asking me why the highest versus the best. And for everybody that is inspired to do something, that is being inspired is because of what you're putting out. And just like Pete said, I mean, and you know, I always have imposter syndrome, both when I get a guest on the podcast or when people actually say they listen to it. And if you do impact one person in this audience of ours, I think it's why we do it.
Absolutely.
I have to say the comments have blown me away, actually. I've been utterly surprised by them. And these are just people wanting to share their stories. But I was also struck by Ren the other day that really set me away thinking, that said, you do realize that the people who need to see these videos aren't going to be looking at your channel. So I was trying, I've been wrestling with a way to try to square them. And I think I've come up with one that, because initially I was going to say, because we all know the idea of, we all know that we should do a little bit more. If you're sedentary, that the best thing you can do is move. And if you're moving a little bit, the best thing you can do is move a bit more. And I've got doctors who say this. And I was thinking, it's how you frame that message in a way that's not patronizing or and we reach an audience and maybe in an encouraging way. So that's something I've been working on recently. I was going to do one like tell your friend, but that sounded too patronizing. So I think just never too late is going to be a message that because there's a lot of people do watch, I know, and go, I wonder have I passed that point where I can start doing these sort of things. Can you be careful you don't put people off? And it's all about, I get, but the thing that I've found from doing this, the one common denominator in all of them, it's finding your thing, finding the thing that does it for you, whether it's cycling, whether it's climbing mountains, whether it's cold water swimming. It doesn't even have to be that. You've gone out for a walk with your dog. It's finding your thing. And then once you're in that area, things will happen. Once you're doing that, things will happen. And then something else, something maybe bigger, will find you. Maybe it is bike packing across Europe. Maybe it's walking south of America. You don't know what it is, but once you're open and receptive to that, things find you.
Which has been your modus operandi, it sounds like, because that's exactly what you've told us. You've basically fallen into these things because you've been open to it. And a lot of this reminds me of your video about the four key attitudes essential for healthy aging, or something about the attitudes, the four attitudes, and ignoring stereotypes. Very, very important, right? Because you I think you're now 65.
Yeah.
And you are a very fit 65-year-old, and but if you were to fall into the stereotype, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. You'd be out golfing, or you. Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with golfing.
No, nope.
Those golfers out there, I don't golf, but you'd be doing something far more sedentary, and you're out there gravel biking, mountain biking.
It's the find your thing. If golfing is your thing, that's great, because exactly. You might start doing that. The other might then decide, I know, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go over to Scotland. I'm going to go play the old course at St. Andrews. I'm going to do a tour of that.
Right.
And that whole the cultural thing opens up, the friendship thing opens up, because you're going on a tour with people, all that sort of thing. And it'll find you if you started golfing, for example. I'm sure there are things to, and I don't play yes. golf. I hit divots further than I hit golf balls. But yeah, it is about finding your thing. Ian's been looking for it. You can't just sit back and wait. Oh, I know. Let's just put my feet up and see if something fine. That's not going to work, obviously. So it's being receptive and open to ideas. And in fact, actually, there's one actually. Can I go off on a little, not a tangent, but tell you a little bit about what's coming next? Because
we encourage it. We encourage it.
Yes.
And tangential thought.
Definitely.
Okay. Excuse me. It's not actually. It's a logical extension. There's a video I did. I can't remember even what it's called now. But a chap who I was at school with, who I think we last saw each other when we were 15 years old, called John Parker. He now lives in, I want to say, Toronto. I'm pretty sure he's in Toronto. His family went out there, took him with. He used to play in the second row with me at rugby, and then they put him in the centre. And he came back to the UK. He got in touch with me first. He came back because he wanted to ride, to cycle. He's big into cycling. He wanted to cycle the North Coast 500, which is a 500-mile loop around northern Scotland. And it's really a marketing tool. That's all it is. Mark Beaumont set the record for going around it on a bike. And that made it really popular as a cycling destination. But the way the marketing has gone, it's become sort of our Route 66. So it's incredibly popular for cyclists, but it's also incredibly popular for people in semi supercars, in the Porsches, in the McLarens. It's also become increasingly popular for people in camper vans, especially during lockdown. So they'll fly over to Scotland and they'll rent something the size of a small house, having used to be driving little cars around cities, and then try and pilot this down some of the narrowest roads in the British Isles, usually single track, so you have to keep pulling over to let cars come the other way. If you were a cyclist and you were in the middle of all this, it's suboptimal. It's not a great experience. If you were there in the height of summer, when Jim did it, early April, it was fine. And it was, I remember the first day with him, and I was thinking, first of all, I was thinking, I wonder if there's a kind of an off-road way we could do this. But there's not. You can't really quite, just the way the roads work. So I started thinking, I wonder, is there, could we create something that's not a North Coast 500? Could we have a West Coast 500 that only cyclists could do, because so much of it would be off-road on rideable gravel, not stuff where we've got to carry a bike, rideable gravel, with plenty of places and lots of little ferries that you connect, that you can get on really easily with a bike. You can't with a vehicle because you've got to book it 3 weeks in advance. So that's the current project, actually. That's the next adventure, because I did some of it towards the end of last year. I wrote a little bit more of it recently, and I've got a kind of a link that I've got to put in, and that's the current thing that found me, and that I have to yet finish off doing. And then I'm going to look for someone who can put some put some clout behind it to get some publicity for it, and see how it goes. But that's the idea.
Love it. What's the distance? What will the distance be? Do you forecast?
It kind of depends. I like the idea. It doesn't really matter in a way. Because what I want to do is I want to have a couple of options. so you can extend it to go out and explore some islands. It's going to be around 500. It's going to be doable in 2 weeks by most people. So it's going to be around between 400 and 500 miles. But in case people want to do it in stages, there's some new train carriages come onto the West Highland Line. And there are two towns. One's the one near me, which is Fort William, and the other one's a place called Oban. And they are both served by these rail carriages. And each of these carriages takes 16 bikes. They are the Highland Explorer. And that's way unusual for us, because normally you can at most get six on one of our regular trains. So it's the whole thing would be looped around those two places. And there is a cycleway almost all the way between both of them, and a segregated cycleway almost all the way between those two towns. So that opens up so many options, and you can create lobes. You've got a left-hand side, you've got a right-hand side, and you've got a little bit at the bottom where you all kind of come together. So that's the current plan.
Brilliant. I'll come out and ride it when you got it done. I'd love to ride it.
Well, right. Well, okay. Just gonna hold it. You can try and Ben Nevis as well. There you go.
There you go.
You know how a lot of people say, oh, I'll go do that. Laval will actually go do that.
Oh, really? Okay, great. Funny enough, we were at the bottom edge. I've been at Ben Nevis loads of times. It's actually, if you go up the tourist route, it's really quite dull. There are some fantastic ways up. You would love going up Tower Ridge. It would be brilliant. It's a fantastic mountain if you approach it from that side.
It looks stunning.
Go up the Carnmore Jarrig and then go along the Arete. It's a great way up the Ben. Yeah.
What have you learned from doing the Always Another Adventure YouTube channel and broadcast, or what the project? And then what have you learned from the Aging Athletes project? There must be some real important stuff. I mean, I was kind of shocked at the cardiac calcium scores from endurance athletes as they age.
Yeah. In fact, I was speaking this can I talk about this? I was speaking this morning to a really good friend who had, I only wonder because it's going into a medical thing for someone. I'll not say his name, but he was quite well known, but he's a good in this part of the world. He's a good friend. And it was exactly that. It was a cult. He had angina, and it was coronary artery calcification. And he, we're actually going to do a film. We decided about this, and he had to get a double bypass. A most amazing thing. This is absolutely phenomenal. And I learned this morning from speaking to him. So he had three of his coronary arteries were calcified. He was suffering angina. He couldn't hill walk. He's a mountaineer. He couldn't hill walk even as much as he wanted to do. And when they did the CT scan on him, they had to do a. They knew they were going to have to do an open heart thing on him and do coronary bypass. The one that was fully calcified, completely blocked, had grown a new artery around the blockage. That was the one they didn't have to do anything with. The other two were the ones they had to do stuff
for. Amazing.
I mean, that just blew me away. I had no idea your body could do that. I mean, in learning all... the question was about what you learn. I mean, it's stuff like that. It's loads of things. I think at a really prosaic level, it is just... kind of how to do YouTube, how different YouTube is to telly. As someone who likes making videos and films and stuff like that, get to the point real quick. And in fact, when you look at your metrics within YouTube, you can see the drop-off within 30 seconds. You can see how many people are still watching at the 30-second mark, and there's a percentage that if you don't hit, your video is not going to get recommended. It's that brutal that the algorithm, the YouTube will actually listen to the words that are being said within those first 30 seconds. They have to match what's in the title and what people have been searching for. And if they, those three things align and people are still staying with you, you score higher. So it's been stuff like that that I've learned from a sort of like a how to tell a story thing. It's been how to work without a cameraman. You've always been used to having someone there pointing a camera at you. How to actually do stuff by yourself and still make it interesting so it's not just a POV shot. Coming back to the sort of the broadcasting side of it all the time. And for the older athlete stuff, honestly, I just don't know where to begin. Every time I go into these things, every time I go into a subject to explore and get somebody in front of me, especially an expert to talk to, it's being back at school in a sense. And it's my job then to get that global size bucket of information and then squeeze it out of a hose pipe size delivery in the right order that people can take in and just get the pertinent bits. That's kind of hopefully what I try to do.
For our listeners that don't know the Always Another Adventure podcast and YouTube series, you're also doing product reviews. How did you fall into that? Was that just something that organically happened, or did somebody reach out to you and said, hey, test these tires or check this or test this hover air drone? Or
yeah,
how did that work?
It's really a bit like that. I mean, there is not a day go by when I don't get an offer to test another blooming e-bike or try this product, try that product. And I was talking again with this with my pal, who's also got a YouTube channel, and you just don't want to be that person where you're using it just to get free, and he said something like, to get free stuff so you can get free stuff in exchange for a video. That's usually what the marketing deal is. Make a video, we'll give you this free. So I'm not interested in that. I've really got to be, if it's something like, for example, that Hover X1 drone actually is a very good example, because they wrote to me and I initially thought, well, I'm not a tech channel. I don't use this sort of stuff. Why would I review this? And then I looked at a little video that somebody had done with it. And I thought, actually, do you know what? That could be absolutely brilliant, not just for YouTubers. It could be brilliant for anybody who's off-road, cycling off-road. That could be a really nice thing. Because you just don't have to review pumps and pedals, you know? I mean, I don't know a thing about it. So I thought that one could be quite good. So I said yes to it. Obviously, immediately after that, every drone manufacturer on the, well, not everyone, but loads of particularly Chinese or Taiwanese drone manufacturers said, do you want to review everything? Do you want to review everything? No, because I don't review drones. This one is not just a drone. This one was actually something really unusual, really special. And so I said yes to it. But yeah, I do really try and pick, am I interested in that? Yeah, okay, then I'll find it. Give you a brilliant case in point. Company Redshift Sports, which I bet you know because of all the stuff they've done. They've done quite a bit for triathlon, yeah?
Of course.
Yeah. Years ago, when I was starting out, I wrote to them because I suffer a little bit from sore thumbs in my wrists. And I said, is there any chance I could get a discount on a stem, please? Because they're quite expensive. And if it's good, I'll review it on the YouTube channel. And we've just had a relationship over the years because they said, yeah, sure. I think I had about 5,000 viewers at that point. Now, they have... Oh, gosh. Well, this will be going out afterwards, so I can say this. On the 3rd of April, they are going to be releasing a new handlebar, and it's embargoed until then. So I shouldn't be talking about it until then, but anyway. And when I got hold of it, the idea is to put you in a... It's for long-distance bike-packing rides, and it's called the Top Shelf Bar. Mm-hmm. And it is a bit higher. It puts your handlebars a bit higher than they normally would be. And I thought, well, why would you want that if you've got a good bike fit? But actually, on a long, melty day ride, how you wake up on day three, how you wake up, your body wakes up feeling on day three is not usually the same as it wakes up when you're at home in your own bed, what have you. If you've been sleeping on the ground for 3 days and you're absolutely bushed because you've been doing a couple hundred K every day, having that just slightly higher position, that could be quite useful. And it's also quite good for an older athlete. So I'm quite happy to do stuff about that because that seems to fit the channel. And I will say that, you know, I got these things free. I didn't buy them. And so make of that what you want. So turn down stuff. I got offered an electronic group set recently, a new one. And I said, listen, I wouldn't know how to put this on my bike, let alone be in a position to review it, because I've only got experience of one, which happens to be on my other bike. But I'll tell you some people who would be quite good, and I pointed them towards some other channels that do that sort of thing. So I definitely turned down an awful lot more than I would do, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. I turned down more than I accept, a lot more.
Your review of the Hover Air X1 drone caused me to pick one up.
What were you thinking there?
Hopefully they're listening, right? They know Simon.
Brand new. I haven't
tried it yet. At least one sale. One direct sale.
Yeah. I haven't. I just got it, so I'll let you know. But, I mean, it looks like it's perfect for these types of things because a lot of the stuff I do, I'm on my own. So.
Mm.
And it's remarkably small. It's hard to describe how light and small it is. You can easily fit it in your jersey pocket of your bike.
If people don't know what we're talking about, God, I'm going to sound like a blooming salesman here, but I'm actually genuinely excited about this bit of tech. The clever thing about it is you can talk to it like it can be hovering 2 meters from your face, making a heck of a noise because it's got these four rotors going full tilt. And yet it's got built-in noise cancelling. So you can be speaking to it with a mic. The microphone goes into your phone. It's recorded on your phone. And then the two things, when they bring the pictures together with that, the noise cancelling software cuts out the noise of the rotors. And that's just... I bet DJI are reverse engineering one of those right now. And the DJI hover version is going to be coming out in the next couple of years. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Well, listen, gents, it's been an hour. It's now 10 o'clock at night here in Vietnam.
Oh,
and we have lots more to talk about, so we're going to have to do a part two.
Yeah, can we? Let's just stay up right now. We need a part two of this, Simon.
It seems like we just barely dipped our toes in.
I know. I feel like we could start a totally separate podcast feed, the three of us. This has been an absolute pleasure. I really hope that we get to talk more. And by the time we're able to host you again, if you're able to carve out the time, which would be a real pleasure, I will have consumed much more of your YouTube content by then.
I was great. Thank you very much. I'll appreciate the advertising revenue.
But you're obviously impacting a lot of people.
Listen, it's been great talking with you guys, because I have to say, this is only the third time I've been a guest on somebody's podcast. And it's really odd being the one answering the questions to being the one asking the questions. Imposter syndrome isn't strong enough a word for the phrase when you asked me to do this. It's like, you sure you got the right person? So thank you so much for having me on. It's actually been fun, and I hope I haven't talked too much. I do have a habit of doing that.
We will provide links in the podcast notes where people can find your channel, and we'll be in touch, Simon.
That's great. Really keep up the excellent work as well. So really, please keep up the excellent work with the podcast. It's good. It's great. You're doing a good job.